My name is Lars Egeland, and I'm director of the Oslo Metropolitan University Library. I would like to wish you welcome to Oslo and to Oslo Metropolitan University. Something about Oslo, I guess you know, it's the capital of Norway, the largest city with around 650,000 inhabitants. And you might have seen already, it's a compact city surrounded by the Oslo Fjord on its south side and forest and mountains north and west. So it's a city where you can go skiing in the winter and you can swim in the summer. And we like to think that Norway is an egalitarian and transparent society, and that that means that we are easy to connect with. Oslo have great ambitions as a green city, and it was also last year a green capital for in Europe. As you've seen, the city center is easily covered by on foot. It's a great connectivity to nature, which we tend to think is a central Norwegian value. And Oslo's aspiration is to be a green capital and be the first fossil-free city in the world by 2030. You will see that there is a lot of electric cars in the streets, and in some few years the whole city center will be car-free. It's a fast-growing and diverse region, one of Europe's fastest-growing cities, and also the most diverse population in Norway. And that's have implications for the university. We have attractions like the Munch Museum, which is open, the Viking Ship Museum, which is open, Holmenkollen Ski Jump, and this weekend there will be a ski festival, and they expect around 40,000 people to come. And we have the opera, which you see here. And this is a new public library that will open later this month. Something about Oslo Met, delivering knowledge to solve societal challenges is the aim of the university, and of course also the aim of the university library. We have 21,000 students, 2,500 employees, 63 bachelor programs, 42 master programs, 6 PhDs, divided into 4 faculties, 21 institutes, 2 research centers, and we are situated on 2 campuses. This is the main campus, and then we have 1 campus in the outskirts of Oslo. And something about the university library. We have 4 libraries, 3 here at the main campus, 1 at the other campus, Kjeller. And we also have organized us with a department of collection and systems, which do all the internal work for the other libraries. And we have a unit for academic language and practice, which contains mostly of academic staff that teach English for academic purposes, that teach people that are employed from abroad, learn them Norwegian, and also help immigration people with immigration background to cope with Norwegian. And we have a media department that produces films and digital content. The staff is approximately 75. Something about the library and the publishing. We have, as many of you, institutional research and learning repositories. We publish 15 research journals and a university publication series. We also run a small publishing house, ABM Media, on the field of archive, library, and museum. And that is because we also have the library education, one of the 2 library educations for Norway here at Oslo Met. And we have a film archive, FilmMet, We wanted to call it Netflix. We weren't allowed to do that. And we have, and that will be presented later, the bookshelf, digital courses. Some screenshots from that. And some numbers about the library. We have approximately 3,300 daily visits, approximately 100,000 loans a year, and 1.3 million digital loans. So we are mainly digital. In addition, 260 downloads of films a year, and 500,000 downloads from repositories and journals. We also work with exhibitions and events, approximately 40 a year. And, of course, lectures for students and staff. Lectures to approximately 12,000 students a year, a little more than half the number of students, and 3,000 appointments for counseling. And tomorrow we'll have an event because 8th of March, but then we are not on the campus, but 8th of March is the Women's Liberation Day, so we celebrate that tomorrow, and this is from the celebration last year. I have to say something about the coronavirus. You might be worried. I made this yesterday, and then the status for coronavirus in Norway was 33 people infected. Now it's 57. None of them are seriously ill or have been admitted to hospital. They are linked out to outbreaks in Italy, one from Iran and a couple from China. And the infected people are isolated at home and are being followed up by local healthcare service. And the recommendation is that healthy people who have stayed in areas with an ongoing transmission of the virus, and that is mainland China, Hong Kong, Singapore, Japan, Iran, South Korea, and some regions in Italy, if people have stayed there during the 14 last days and develop symptoms of respiratory disease, they should seek medical attention at once, and we can help you with that. And healthy people who have been in close contact with confirmed case, some person diagnosed with the virus during the 14 last days, should also seek medical advice. And that means in reality that they will have to stay home. So the recommendation for this conference is that persons with symptoms of the disease, fever, cough, respiratory symptoms, shall not participate at the conference. And besides that, cough etiquette and good hand hygiene. Cough etiquette is either in a paper towel or in your arm if you need to cough, and wash your hands very often. That will reduce the risk of respiratory infections. Then, I think that was information that was important to give. Then I will give the floor to Ann Åkerson, co-convener of the Special Interest Group on Library Publishing.
Okay, thank you. I guess I get to welcome you, even though I'm not from Oslo. But this has been splendid. I have been planning for a couple of months, watching the weather, saying I had better bring boots with traction in case it's slippery and icy and lots of warm clothes, and prepare to stay in my hotel room because it will be too cold to go out. But none of those things has been true the last couple of days. It's been absolutely fantastic. And so, Lars, we thank you and your crew for this wonderful setting and this wonderful invitation. You'll get to hear more about the IFLA Library Publishing Special Interest Group, SIG, tomorrow when we have a short business session. But in brief, we really organized ourselves at the IFLA World Library Congress in 2018 in Kuala Lumpur. Lars was there and some other colleagues. And it was clearly a group with passion. Immediately on the spot, or almost on the spot, two people who are in the audience today, whom I will introduce in a minute, offered the first midterm for the SIG, and they organized it with the help of a planning committee in absolutely short order. So we met in Dublin, Ireland, for the first time a year ago, pretty much exactly. Lars was there, and so on. We had a wonderful conference around this size, this type of agenda, and we're going to do the same here, if not better, of course. Something I wanted to ask, who here is from Norway? A lot of people from Norway. Who is here from outside the European community? It's quite... Okay, well... So that's more than I expected. Now I'm trying to figure out who's here from farthest away. So it's going to be someone outside the European Union. You people who raised your hands, tell us where you're from. Start in the back here.
Detroit, Michigan.
Washington State. Who is that?
Leah.
That's a ways away. You may get that prize. Yeah?
Vancouver.
Well, it may be a draw between the two of you.
U.S. Arizona.
Arizona. Not quite as far as Pacific Northwest. Yeah.
Pennsylvania.
No, not as far. And I'm from Connecticut, so that's not as far either. But anyway, welcome, and especially for those of you who've made such an effort to get here, but really to everyone. I just want to name a few names, and then I will sit down. But first of all, I do want to acknowledge Jane Buggle and Marie O'Neill. They're sitting right there. Put your hands up higher. These are the two ladies from Ireland who led the organization of the midterm meeting last year. And they're here this year because they couldn't stay away. Right. So we thank them for their presence and leadership and providing a kind of continuity, which we will continue with Lars. There are a number of, well, the SIG operates with a kind of a small informal steering group. And Marie and Jane and Lars and I are on that group, but there are people who could not attend, and I just want to name them because they really wanted to be here. The convener of the group with me is Reggie Raju from South Africa, little far to come. Ekaterina Shibayeva from Russia, also could not attend. Grace Liu from Canada, Windsor, Fiona Bradley, and Heather Todd from Australia. So these folks could not be here, but I understand we are or we will be streaming live so that at least they can catch some of the proceedings. So on behalf of IFLA and the SIG and everybody, thank you for coming. We really look forward to this.
Thank you, Anne.
Good morning. My name is Allie Laird. I am one of the people that came from across the sea to get here, so I'm very excited to be here. I'm the Open Publishing Program Specialist from Penn State University in Pennsylvania, United States. And I'm going to be chatting with you today on using Drupal as an open publishing platform in the libraries. So a few clarifications to start. I am not a Drupal programmer or expert by any means. So just when questions come up, just to clarify that, I will do my best to answer within the capacity that we use Drupal. But I'm very lucky to have some folks in the libraries that are Drupal experts that assist our publishing program. And also, we don't use Drupal for the submission or peer review process, and I'll get into that as we go through later. But we use it mostly to host the publications that we have that are ready. So we use Drupal as a publishing platform for primarily our bibliographies. That is the platform that we use for these types of publications the most. We have a handful of monographs that we've started publishing in the past 2 years that we also use Drupal to publish with, and then a handful of publications that we call topical web portals. They are basically digital humanities type publications, so those that don't fall within the traditional, you know, monograph, journal, bibliography type publications. And why we use Drupal is because we already have a handful of technical support and development staff members in the libraries that are already using Drupal for a variety of different purposes. So it was very convenient to be able to tap into that knowledge and support and use this platform, this thing for publishing. So what is Drupal for those that are unfamiliar? Drupal is a free open source web content management framework that's written in PHP, and it's distributed under the GNU General Public License. So the GNU General Public License is basically the software equivalent of like a Creative Commons license. So it's freely available for anyone to download, to modify, to use, which makes it also extremely beneficial and helpful in our publishing program, because we do host it locally at our university, and thus we are able to kind of modify it for whatever purposes we need for our publications. So Drupal is being used in the Penn State libraries for quite a while, as I said. Many of those ways were our general library publishing website. So this is our library website, excuse me. So this is just a screenshot of when you go to libraries.psu.edu, a bit of what the website looks like. We also use Drupal for our staff web pages, our staff blog posts, those types of things. We also use it for our center and institutes websites, and also for our library collection pages and what we call microsites. So this is kind of a collaboration of the two. At Penn State, we have different centers. One of them is the Civil War Era Center, and this is a collaboration project between the university libraries and that center. So in many ways, this would be called technically a microsite within the libraries, because it hosts some different digital collections, some digitized materials that are hosted in collaboration with the libraries and this center on campus. And then also our library's open publishing publications. And this is just a snapshot of what you'll see when you go to openpublishing.psu.edu. So a quick overview of how we use Drupal for publishing the content. When content comes to us, we review it, and it's approved by a library publishing advisory board that we have that's currently made up of 4 members, and then myself as the ex officio non-voting member, as the coordinator of the publishing program in the libraries. And then once that content is finalized, with either the editor or the author, depending on if it's a bibliography, topical web portal, that kind of thing, and it's prepared for publishing, that's when we then move it into Drupal for hosting and publication. So those steps are initiated by meeting with our development team, our library strategic technologies team, to establish what the requirements for the publication are and then what the timeline is going to look like. That development team then will create the skeleton of the Drupal site, depending on, you know, what type of publication we're doing. And then it's up to the library's open publishing department to then migrate all of that content into Drupal and prepare it. You'll see we'll talk a little bit later about some minor text editing that we do in code cleanup whenever it goes, especially if you're migrating content from Word, because as we know, Word can sometimes have some very tricky coding in there that we don't necessarily want to keep. And then we go through and make sure there's that style uniformity, and then also web accessibility, especially when it comes to colors, how things are displayed on the screen, that kind of thing. And that kind of goes hand in hand with the theming that we do. And we'll work with the publication editors or authors to figure out what type of theme they want depending on their publication, any images or branding they might have, that kind of thing. So for bibliographies, this is the homepage of what our largest and kind of most famous bibliography looks like when you go to it. This is actually the premier utopian bibliography in literature. We just had a celebration earlier this month because the editor has exceeded 10,000 entries in his bibliography, so it's quite expansive. So we use a module called Biblio in Drupal to host these and publish these. We have an active developer in the library who actually contributes and monitors the different developments and code commits in GitHub that others around the world are doing to Biblio. And we're actually one of probably not a huge handful of people that are taking advantage of this Biblio module to publish bibliographies. So we're very lucky that he's very involved in that. This is what it looks like whenever you search the bibliography. It allows for organization of individual entries, including some customizable fields, which is why it's so helpful for publishing a bibliography. You can also export the information, the citations, in a variety of different formats. So it helps for using kind of the content as data and being able to not only cite more easily the bibliography content, but also to compare, use it in whatever type of research, capacity people are using it for. And you can also refine your search and then also export just that specific search if that's something that is important to you. They also allow for static information pages, such as this one. He has a very long introduction article on why his bibliography is important, kind of the history going into it. And so in order to kind of give an overview of how we set that up, the request comes to us, which then gets, approved through our advisory board. We then get the site from our library strategic tech, and then we customize it. So to kind of go back and give you an idea of customizing, again, that top banner, it doesn't seem like a whole lot, but that's something that, we would do, making sure that, back on this front homepage, his image is in there correctly, things set up in there the way that he wants it.
Det bildens på staying alive. Bare for å slippe overdøve alle.
Then we will take the editor's content and we prepare it for upload into Drupal. So that's kind of the bulk of the work whenever it comes to preparing the content to be published. We work in collaboration with the editor, make sure all of their content, all of their information is correct. There are no typos, all of those types of things. And I also have if there is any in there, because some bibliographies are just starting up fresh. We'll set up the site. If they have a small amount of entries, they can add those entries themselves later. And I'll, share about that in a second. But if there is content, of which most of the time there is, we verify that content usually in Excel before we then convert it to an XML file for upload into Drupal, where it will then organize the content. You can go in and add additional changes and edits once it's already up into Drupal. And then after that, if it's an ongoing bibliography where additional entries are going to be added, we create an account for the editor, and then they can log in and continuously add content going forward. So here is an overview of what that screen looks like when they log in. It's under the tab Create Biblio, and then you give your the publication a title, and then you go through all of these different tabs on the sidebar and add, if you have the abstract, if you have, any identifiers, those types of things. And our bibliography editors definitely take full advantage of all of those areas to add as much thorough information as they can. For monographs, these are a little bit more straightforward. As I said, we don't use Drupal for authoring or for peer review processes. So it's really taking that finalized content and migrating it into Drupal to be displayed and published. This is a screenshot of what the kind of title page looks like for one of our monograph publications. It's on immigration and from the Center of Immigration, the Penn State Law's Center for Immigration Rights Clinic. So it had, a collection of chapters or articles, and then some really fantastic photos that they had taken that they were able to integrate into this to make the title page look very interesting. So again, all of that theming and stuff were things that we worked on with the editor to prepare for publication. So for the monograph setup, again, after it's accepted, we take the content, we prepare it for Drupal, and this is generally done in Word, as we're making sure that there are no typos, that we kind of have all the heading information that we need, that we're putting in the author, information at the top, the way we need it, biographies, those kinds of things. And then we provide the basic theming in Drupal. We migrate the content into Drupal and do some basic code cleanup, again, to make sure nothing is displaying weirdly, which it will if you don't do that cleanup, and also to make sure that everything is uniform, again, throughout the publication. And we don't use, again, for authoring or review process. So this is an example of what it looks like on that title page if you were to click on one of the essays. So you can read through the essay, read through the chapter. It has the table of contents on the side. And additionally, once you get to the bottom of the page, you can just click the next button, and it will take you to the next chapter as you read through it. And then this is what it looks like on the back end whenever you're migrating the content into it. So again, adding the title, adding the text into that body. Under that text format button, or section, I guess I should say, at the bottom, you can look at it in full HTML or in plain text. And plain text is where we'll go through and make sure there's no weird coding or styling happening on the back in the background that we don't want. And then also image right there, that's where you can upload those images that will then be displayed on that title page because of the theme that we used. And so we used those, all of those fields to kind of prepare that publication that you saw. And this is the kind of the bottom of the page, you know, prefix image or suffix image. That's whether you want it to be before in that block before or after the article, those types of things. And again, down under book outline, the weight is then where we will select kind of where it falls within that table of contents. So where that chapter shows up within the entire publication. And then for topical web portals, it's kind of a combination of both, which is why I have it here at the end. Our topical web portals, as I said, really fall under something that's not really a book, not really a bibliography, but most of the time they have elements of both. Many topical web portals will include a bibliography that kind of accompanies or supplements their larger, you know, publication. Most of the time we'll have both of those things. We also really heavily utilize the static information pages, so just, you know, historical information or additional resources, those types of things. Many of them, or one in particular, has a blog that the editor, author likes to, you know, continually update and add information about her current research. There could be articles, case studies, abstracts, et cetera. And one of them definitely has a an image collection, I should say, of different types of materials that she includes within both her bibliography and in her research. Mapping elements, those types of things, all of that can be kind of included within a topical web portal. So this is that topical web portal that we have. The Union Catalog for Early Movable Books is what she calls her bibliography portion of that. Learning as Play is the name of the entire topical web portal collection. Some of her pages she's still migrating into Drupal because she had started this project in WordPress, which is why I'm not including all of the pages here, but it really includes a bibliography, a map, image collection, and then static
information.
So just a few final takeaways, since I know I ran through really quickly. Drupal works excellently for our bibliographies and topical web portals. We probably won't, so long as, you know, Biblio and everything like that continues, you know, working and being supported, we're probably not going to change how we're doing things, because we really, really feel that Drupal works perfectly for the bibliographies. Monograph publishing is one that we had this tool at our fingertips, and we're very excited to be able to use it to be able to expand our portfolio to publishing monographs. Perhaps in the future, if we have, you know, additional funding or other opportunities to look into some of the very awesome monograph publishing tools that are coming out, we may eventually, you know, migrate to one of those, especially if it has other tools, you know, such as authoring or things that would be more beneficial to us. I could see us moving to that. But the biggest takeaway is that you really can and should leverage the resources that you're already using in the libraries and the expertise that other departments that you have at your fingertips, because it can really help you to expand your publishing program and provide support sooner than perhaps waiting around to try and, you know, get justification for some other type of software for, you know, monograph publishing as an example. So thank you very much. If you want to take a closer look at any of the publications that I mentioned, as I said, you can go to openpublishing.psu.edu and poke around. Otherwise, I think questions are at the end of all the sessions. Thank you.
Thank you. Very crisply done. The second of our platform discussions will be by Cheryl Ball of Wayne State University Libraries in the United States. She will be speaking on Vega, starting a new OA academic publishing platform. Cheryl, welcome.
Thank you. I am so excited to be back at Oslo Met. I was here last June for the NFIP conference, the Norwegian Forum for English for Academic Purposes conference, with Christy and a bunch of folks who work in the academic writing program here. That's my other half of my life was as a faculty member who taught academic literacies for 15 years. But I migrated into publishing several years ago because of a journal that I edit named Kairos. And I'm not going to talk about Kairos today, but you should go look it up. It's spelled K-A-I-R-O-S. And it's a multimedia, scholarly multimedia journal that's been publishing online in open access form since 1996. And we ran into the problem about 15 years ago that we realized we needed a content management system that could handle the capabilities of the kinds of texts that Kairos published, but there wasn't anything, and there still really isn't anything that can handle that specific kind of text. And if you're familiar with the kinds of the web projects that Ali was talking about, or digital humanities types of projects, or digital research-based projects that use a lot of visualization or video or interactivity, that's what the kind of stuff is that Kairos and journals like it publish. So we really couldn't use something like Drupal or Open Journal systems where you're embedding a little piece into something else. We needed a content management system that would allow what we call a web text instead of an article to use the full affordances of the internet and of the web in order to convey its design as well as its rhetorical argument. So finally, after quite some time, we were able to raise some funds and get a grant from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation to build Vega. Now, the Norwegians in the room might know the title of this differently, because this project actually started in Oslo when I was here 5 years ago for a Fulbright. I was a Fulbright scholar at AHO, one of the other universities in town, the Architecture and Design School across town, where I was collaborating with my partner Andrew Morrison over there, who's a design professor, and we hatched this idea with a local design studio. It was then named Bengler, and they've rebranded as Sanity. So the local folks in the room might be familiar with the some of the players in Oslo that we've been working with. But I'm really excited to sort of come full circle to talk to you about where Vega is 5 years on and give you a status update back in Norway, which is great. So we do have a website. We've been slow to publish things just because it's a very small team working on this publishing platform. And it's we created Vega from the ground up. It's a brand new system that doesn't build on any other systems, which has its ups and downs, right? It's not like we're just adding features to Drupal or plugins to OJS, Open Journal Systems. We've architected this to be for multimedia forward born digital publications from the outset. And so we have some updates that we've published, including some recent ones. We just hired a new web developer after about 8 months of looking for some funding for that. We were able to get some internally. So I encourage you to go to the website to check around a couple of things that we've got there. And there's the URL also for our website. And then again, some of the partners that we've been able to work with on this project throughout the last 5 years. And now the grant started when I was at West Virginia University, but now I've gone to Wayne State, where there's a much larger, robust library publishing program. So we've teamed with about 8 librarians and library staff members at Wayne State, which is in the heart of Detroit, Michigan in the U.S., to continue developing this project. So I was afraid that would happen. Well, it's a little postmodern, just like Vega. we like to do interactive experimental work here with Vega. So some of the features that I wanted to briefly talk with you about today is that Vega is a soup to nuts program, as they might say. In other words, it has an authoring platform. We don't yet have a submission management system, but that's part of what we're going to be building with phase two, so that authors can upload their work, they can author the work also in the system if they want, or they can copy and paste it from other systems, and the system will scrape all of any garbage that happens with HTML or Word or Google Drive authoring, to clean it up to create structured text out of it. That authoring platform also doubles as the editing platform. So peer review and copy editing can happen within the system. And it is built currently so that you can have both double anonymous peer review, sort of traditional blind peer review, if we will. I don't call it blind review because I find that's too ableist. So I like to call it anonymous peer review. The Vega supports that kind of system, as well as an open or crowdsourced peer review option, if you would like. So it's really pushing on that idea of openness as much as possible in the way that work gets accomplished in scholarly communications. in that way, authors and editors can come together in the publishing platform collaboratively, simultaneously, just like they might in Google Drive, as another example. So that can happen. And then the system tracks how work moves through. This is an example of the authoring platform. Everything's done sort of in chunks. The way that WordPress has more recently been sort of revised, if you're familiar with that system, so you have text blocks that happen in a much more structured way. This is a screenshot of our workflows, our workflow tab. One of our very, very earliest partners, not partners, but like collaborators on this project was a journal called Form Akademisk, which is published out of Oslo Met. So we've got that listed as the example in the upper left-hand corner. It's a design pedagogy journal that's published in Open Journal Systems here. Here's an example of what the interface would look like if you are a journal editor and going in and you want to track where your submissions are, where the articles, or this also works for monographs or any other kind of data that you might want to put into the system. So you can name things in the different sections. Here we've got book reviews, case studies, letters, original articles, but those can be changed super easily within the system, within this interface. So you can go in and say, okay, I'm working on an edited book instead of a journal venue. So your book might have different sections like front matter, back matter, case studies, etc. Each of those tracks, as we like to call them in Vega, assumes a particular kind of workflow, editorial workflow that might happen. And so what the system is trying to do is to teach library publishers some of the different ways of publishing different types of material. As we know, and I know IFLA-SIG has been talking about that, and the Library Publishing Coalition out of North America has been working on the library publishing curriculum, which I'm the new editor-in-chief of, and I can talk about that later if y'all want. But we want to help teach people how publishing happens across all the different genres that we might be working in within a library. So Vega sort of accommodates that by saying, okay, if you have case studies, as one example that's listed here in the second row, you might not have the first stage, right? That might not apply in that case. So it would be grayed out in the system because you can set it and say, okay, I need case studies to go through a submission process, a peer review process, and the peer review process needs to be open, you know, publicly open, or open within a confined set of users. It doesn't need to go through copy editing for whatever reason, so you skip that section. And it all happens within one screen. So unlike other programs where you might have to jump back and forth and sign in and sign out in order to get to the kinds of workflows that you might need to create, you can do that all within one screen in Vega. And then it will automatically skip that one for that particular kind of text, the case study. Whereas articles, you might want it to go through everything, and you can just leave that workflow. And if you need to skip or push anything as an editor or a publisher beyond a certain stage, you can do that really easily within just by looking at the article itself. Okay. The other thing that this screen shows you is how many pieces are in each stage in each category at any given time, right? So for instance, we've got three articles in the completed case studies group, and two articles in the completed letters group, et cetera. And you can click on any of those to get into the articles themselves. All right. Whoops, wrong computer. it will show you what issues are in development all at a glance. So this might look like your table of contents that you can click on, and it expands and drops down and shows you how many articles or how many chapters are in a book, as well as the developmental tab color coding that we saw on the other screen, which is also changeable. So at a glance, you can look at all these dots on the right-hand corner and say, oh, okay, this is how many I still need to work on that are in peer review, et cetera. There's a lot of ways of manipulating the metadata in Vega so that you can sort of change them in this really nice GUI interface within the system. And add users and remove users and do it in bulk ways and add... this is an open source platform, so it's infinitely changeable. And we hope other people might participate in the development. Also caveat, I'm not a developer. I'm the project director. So one of our developers created this slide to sort of show how Vega is working technically, and I'd be happy to return to this and maybe parse my way through it. But it's essentially got three different parts that build on Node and a Mongo database, and they sort of all work together to create the graphic studio of Vega. There's a lot of JSON involved. Just summing up, some of the key points about Vega that I want you to be able to take away is this is a free software that is available on GitHub. Anybody can download and use it. It's not very easy to download and use it right now because $1 million only goes so far in development. We've got a couple of little things that we still need to fix, which is why we just hired a web developer to help us tweak those final little things. So, because the period of the grant has ended, right? So we're working to add some more authentication mechanisms because it was built to authenticate with Google, but sometimes we need something that's not Google, right? so this is the problem with free is then we have to go find money, which we're in the process of doing again for the second round of funding. But it is free. It is open source. Anybody can download it and contribute to the code and get it using at their home institution. Our own plans at Wayne State are to bring this up as a hosted platform, which you've seen some of the other development platforms doing lately, so that we can offer hosting services to anyone in the world who wants to start journals and books and other kinds of publications. It is meant to be rich media forward, right? So we want to be able to have authors publish research in the mediums that they need in order to convey their research, whether that's linear text or whether that is audio, video, interactivity, et cetera. The workflows are all flexible and really, really easy to use. And I don't say that lightly because I know the word easy can be a trap. But it's surprising to me every time we've done user testing on this or introduced the systems to someone new, they're like, oh, you know, it takes them a second to sort of wrap their head around the fact that this platform intends publishing to be truly born digital from the moment of conception to the moment of preservation. We get asked a lot, like, where's the track changes feature in this? And I'm like, that's a print-based mechanism for publishing that we don't need in the same ways if we're truly going to be publishing open access work in a digital environment. That's what version control is for, right? So there's some ways to sort of think differently about publishing that I think this platform is going to help us do over the next 10 or 15 years. And then one of the key points that a lot of people do like about Vega is you're not tied to a particular template or structure. This outputs as unopinionated in how you put the output to readers. So while it ships with a particular kind of template, you can output it with a Python front end, with HTML, you can style your CSS in any way you want so that your venue looks however you want it to look and it doesn't have any structure, right? Going back to my first example about Kairos, how we didn't want anything interfering with the web texts, Vega doesn't interfere with how the content of the venue, the scholarly venue, is delivered. Okay, I better wrap up, I suppose. One last word. Again, returning to the Norwegian roots of this program. Maybe none of you in the room will recognize this picture, but I love showing this picture. I often get asked where the name Vega came from, and it's actually the third iteration of the naming because of... Well, the first one ended up being trademarked by someone else. The second one, the Norwegian developers couldn't pronounce. They were like, Cheryl, it's really hard to say Cairn, and they kept saying it like pirates. And so I was like, okay, that's not going to work. They're like, can we change it? And so the folks in Oslo actually suggested that we call the system Vega. And I had a lot of concerns about that, given my American context, because there's all sorts of, like, Chevy Vega was a terrible car that no one should own. Suzanne Vega has a great song called Tom's Diner that will get stuck in your head on an endless loop. So I had concerns, and they said, no, wait. And then they pulled up this picture of Google Earth of the Vega Archipelago, which is off the western coast of Norway. And they showed this to me, and I said, oh my gosh, this is beautiful. Where is it? And they told me about it. And they said there's what, hundreds of islands in this archipelago, and like 200 eider duck, right? And very few people live there. It's a very small fishing village, just if you haven't been there. But I love this photo because it reminded me of a network map. And what I hope with Vega, as with the archipelago, that when the tide comes up, journals and publications, digital publishing, might become subsumed by the water, right? By the layers of things that pile over it on the internet. And we lose digital venues all the time because of that rising tide. But what Vega, we hope, will help us accomplish is that when the tide goes out and more venues rise up to the surface, they're still going to be there, even when the tide comes back in and gets covered over. So we're thinking about Vega as an experimental but also multimedia forward long-term preservation platform for scholarly communication that will always be there, hopefully, as the Vega Archipelago will be. So thank you.
Carol, thank you. So our third speaker this morning will be Marissa McDonald from the Public Knowledge Project in Canada. She will be speaking Shaping the Future of Scholarly Publishing, Library Participation in Enhancing Open Infrastructure. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm going to start off with just a brief introduction just to set the context of who I am and where I'm coming from and why I'm here today. I am the communications coordinator for the Public Knowledge Project. What that means is essentially the work I do is really around engaging with our communities, sharing stories, building relationships, and connecting with community. And I joined PKP in January 2019, so I'm still relatively new to all of this and to meeting everyone who's involved in this community. And communications, really, this is a new role for PKP as well, too. So the other, as everyone else has said so far, I am not a software developer. I am probably the least technical member of the PKP team. So apologies, I can't answer some of the more technical questions today, but I am an advocate for PKP. I'm also here as a librarian, and that's important for me because this isn't just a presentation. I will use examples from my organization, but by no means am I here just to talk about PKP. And I want to encourage, no matter what infrastructure you're using, if you're using open source for library publishing, to encourage you to get involved. So that's my background. I will say Public Knowledge Project, for people who may or may not be aware, you've probably all heard of open journal systems. So we created and maintain open journal systems. But you might not be aware of as our history. PKP began more than 20 years ago, 1998, when our founder and director, John Walensky, was really looking at the issue of how to reduce cost as a barrier to creating and consuming scholarship. He was an education professor. He wanted the students, after they left academia, to still have access to research, for the community to have access to research output. He saw that the cost was a barrier with online information, and we never set out to develop software per se, but that's what happened. So Open Journal Systems was born in 2001, almost 20 years ago, and since then we now have a suite of software, including OJS, Open Monograph Press, and newly launched last week, Open Preprint Systems in beta. We do more than just software, though. We still do, as we began as an academic project, we still do research, education, and advocacy around open access. And we also have a publishing services division as part of our organization. This is where some of the revenue that we get from hosting, from doing consultation, and from doing custom development, that revenue comes back into our organization and helps us fund the software. And we do this with two academic homes. We are administration home at Simon Fraser University Library in Canada, and as well, John Walensky is based out of Stanford University, and that's our research home. So why am I here today? I was inspired by the theme of the conference, which was connecting and empowering library publishers. And the word empowerment really struck with me about, Wikipedia has a quote here, for what it's worth, I liked it. It says, to do work with power. And I really liked that about what libraries were doing and contributing to open infrastructure. And so in my first year with PKP, what I started to notice and identify was some of the really amazing work that library publishing was doing to contribute back to our project. And so I thought I wanted to come here today, share some examples of how you can contribute to open infrastructure using my organization, but also inspiring you, no matter what software platform you're using, why it's important for you to contribute back to open and how you can do that. Really briefly, I'm not going to get into open infrastructure, but I think we are all familiar with this idea of free and open source software. That's what I'm referring to today. Platforms you've already heard of two so far today, with Drupal and Vega. So this is what I'm talking about, these infrastructures. And what's really, really great with library publishing today is that libraries have choice of what to use. And I think this is very empowering. There was a report last year put out by MIT Press called Mind the Gap, and they cataloged 52 open platforms for scholarly publishing. And I think they started with, I think they had upwards of 80 when they started looking at them. So there's a lot of choice out there for you to use. And they described them as durable alternatives. I think it's important to look at ourselves in relation to commercial products as well. And it's really not just about being durable, but how can we be competitive in this market as well, in this area, so that people choose open over some of these solutions. So why would you choose open? We know there's choice. We know you have an option of what to use. And I think there is the option that it is free. That cost definitely does play a factor into why institutions are choosing open. It's flexible, the ability to not lock your data in. Those are some of the values and things that are important. But really, I think it's important. A lot of us here today are choosing open because it meets the values of the institution, the open knowledge. That is why you're supporting open. So it's important to remember that. And if you support open and you support open and you're choosing open because of those values of open knowledge, open access, open source, we have to work together to make it better. There is contributions to make it better. Invest in Open talks about the need for a more integrated, collaborative, and strategic way of working together. And the thing is, we know that community is an important part of open source software, but we have to think about what does that mean? It's not enough that we just use open source software, but it's becoming active and contributing members to these communities. I think there's responsibilities on each side, the users and the service providers, to contribute back to these projects. And I say to rise above corporate publishers, but more so to be competitive with corporate is really what it's about, so that we're choosing open because it is the best option out there and making them the best that they can be. So again, what I mentioned, in my first year with PKP, I started to notice some really valuable contributions that libraries are making. And so I'm going to talk about those different types of contributions to hopefully inspire and empower you to get more involved. And often with open source, we think of code. Developers, software developers contributing code, and there's much more that you can do than that. There's technical, non-technical, and financial. And what I'm going to do is talk a little about each of these contributions, use an example from my own organization to illustrate, and then maybe prompt you to how you might want to get involved with whatever open infrastructure you might be working with. All right, so technical. We heard a little bit earlier about what it means to be free and open source software, the ability to run, copy, distribute, study, change, and I think the most important thing is to improve the software. If you're going to contribute technically, we need to be contributing to improve, and it doesn't have to just be code. And so my example here today is, as I mentioned, we do have a publishing services division to PKP, and so University of Minnesota Libraries Publishing Services sponsored recently development to add article and editorial statistics to open journal systems. So they came to us, asked for this custom development feature to be added to the software, and they provided the funding to enable us to make this happen. This feature now is released in OJS 3.1.2, and as of last Friday, OJS 3.2. the fact that they came to us with an idea, wanted to make the software better, was able to contribute financially towards it, this feature is now available to everyone who uses the software. And that's the beauty of this community work together. When you work towards improving the code and you contribute that code, or your service provider might contribute back that code, that benefits the entire community, and we all get a better product in the end. Another important one from PKP to note is that financial and in-kind contributions come in a lot from our development partners as well. So we have three major ones here. I wanted to talk about Pittsburgh, British Columbia, and Alberta. All three of these institutions are supporting technical development within our software, with being part of technical governance, usability testing, preservation, their expertise, and it's really libraries driving that within our software. So it's important to note that technical contributions can be software developers writing code, but it can also be participating in other things and other ways that improve the software. So if you're using open infrastructure, ways to get involved, look to your service providers, and are they... do they value open practices as well? Are they sharing back code? How can you contribute code? Does the software allow you to contribute code back? And how open is open? I think that's an important consideration. And also looking at whether the infrastructure prioritizes development based on community needs. These are all things you want to look for in your open infrastructure and encourage to get involved. The non-technical, and a lot of times people ask, how can I contribute? I'm not a software developer. There's more to software than code and more to making it better. Documentation, user testing, accessibility, translation. These are all areas in which you're experts and have ideas to contribute back. And the one I'm going to focus on for PKP is our documentation. In Barcelona in November, we had a PKP sprint. That's one of the ways that community comes together to work on the software. And we had a group of scholarly communications librarians came together, and in 2 days, they wrote this instructor guide for course journals for those using OJS. So in just 2 days, they sat down at a table, worked on this particular piece, and it's now available openly in our documentation hub. And so it's just one of those contributions that libraries are taking their expertise, sitting down, and then giving back. We do have a documentation interest group that also works, and it's predominantly led by libraries. So it's very, very interesting to see ways you can give back in documentation. Another one that happened at one of our development sprints is advocating for different changes and features in infrastructure. So we had a sprint part of the Library Publishing Forum, the Library Publishing Coalition, in Vancouver last year, and a group from Ontario came to us and said, we need OJS, we need the software to be more accessible, we need to meet legislation. And so the group sat down and they worked through what would this look like, what do we need to do, and they completed two projects for us at that sprint, and includes a roadmap for us to achieve the web accessibility guidelines required. Libraries were advocating for this to be in our software. They came to us, they came together. Just a really important way that you can contribute is through that advocacy. So look for activities, ways. Does the infrastructure have an event, a community forum, focus groups? What are the ways that you can contribute back to your infrastructure? Is your voice being heard? Can you participate in the governance of these products? Is there a user group that you can join or participate in that then can communicate back to the infrastructure? Really look to what you're using and how you can contribute that way. And the last one is the... not everyone has the means to do this, but financial, of course, is a very important part of contributing to open infrastructure. Free to use does not mean free to develop. And the same regards, it does. You yourselves are also putting in a lot of time and money into the software development within your own institutions, too. There are some examples of libraries that can contribute back. And so 80% of our sustaining members are academic libraries, which I'm thrilled to know. They're an important part of our advisory committee, our technical committee, so they have a voice and they're putting funds towards making it possible. Most recently, PKP was endorsed by SCoS, the Global Sustainability Coalition for Open Science Services, SCoS. What's interesting about SCoS, and so we were one of three, so along with DOAB and OAPEN, Open Citations and PKP, SCOS has endorsed us and said that we are part of the infrastructure in which to, they're seeking funds to help ensure long-term sustainability of these different open infrastructures. So the first round, they were endorsing DOAJ, Sherpa Romeo. The second funding cycle, we've been included. Why I bring this up is that libraries are leading the charge here. So the member organizations of SCOS are coming from libraries, and so they're really the ones that are coming out there and saying, please support these vital infrastructure. And so libraries do have a voice in developing the infrastructure. And so when it comes to financial, it's really looking at how and advocating within your own institution, if you're using open, are there ways to contribute back? Can you become a member of an organization? Can you make a donation? Does your organization able to support financially? Are you part of a consortium that contributes back to open infrastructure? So remember in the financial cost as well, and that those contributions go a long way in making open infrastructure better for everyone. And really, I think we're all of different institutions, different shapes and sizes. The ways that you can contribute doesn't have to just be development, doesn't have to be code, and doesn't have to be money. There's a lot of way that you're already investing your time into open infrastructure. The idea is to remember to not work in that vacuum, not to work in that silo, and to share and to talk and to work with us as a community, work with the infrastructure to kind of share some of the different ways that you're making the software better. For us as PKP, our software is decentralized. We don't know a lot of the times what's happening around the world, what people are doing with our software. So it's important that we listen and learn from the community, and that the community as well communicates back and says we've made these updates and changes, and that we're responsive. So no matter what infrastructure you're using, hopefully there's a way that you can make a contribution and to do more work with power is what I thought today. We've got some, if you'd like to talk to us more about this, we've got Twitter, Facebook, and a community forum. Thank you.
I'm going to present our platform, talk a bit about the results of what the work we've done, talk about why you need to have a platform like our server, and then end up discussing why the libraries, because universities have so many other departments that could do the same work, or perhaps not. But let's start with tisk.dk, journal.dk. We started in 2007. We right now have 153 journals online in yearbooks. We had more than 4 million downloads last year. We're using Open Journal System. We started with that in 2007, so we're quite happy for the software. We see ourselves as a platform provider, not as a publisher, and there's a difference. We use a platform, and the journals have to take care of peer review and all that, copy editing. Because we are rather cheap, we are not a free server, but we're rather cheap. And then the server has been used as inspiration for our platform for ebooks with 240 publications online using OMP. It's so supposed to be open access platform, 136 publications now with immediate open access. The rest have embargoes, mostly 1 year. We have a couple of journals with 5 years embargo, but we were experimenting in the beginning, so they're good old friends of the family, and we don't want to put any kind of pressure on them. So we accept that they have longer embargoes. But if you start today, you're only allowed to have 1 year embargo maximum. The results, well, we have gained access to Danish research. We made it possible for new journals to be born and constructed on the platform. 107 of the journals and yearbooks are active right now. I'm always taking that number up because when I left to Oslo, a new journal came online. So 6 of the journals actually have moved, some of them because we helped the University of Aalborg to create their Open Journal System server. And we said, well, you can start your business in Aalborg, and then some of your journals can start on our server to have a platform. And then we said, when you're ready, you can just take the journals. But still, some of the articles are still on our server. 34 journals published their first issue on the server. And we estimate that about 20 of them could not have been created if we'd not have this kind of service for them. And well, then we have 40 which are radio digitized. It's a long story, but the server in Copenhagen and the server in Aarhus were merged together as the two national libraries merged into one. And the good people in Copenhagen, they did work a lot with digitization of old journals. So a lot of them now are online at our server. And 11 of the journals are previous versions of active journals, because we realized that if you have a journal and you take the old version of the journal with an old title and put it into one instance, you can't produce any good metadata. So we have had to create 11 special journals for this. Now, why should we offer a service like this? Well, I'm a Dane. Only 5 million, perhaps 6 million people understand or talk Danish. And then the good people from Norway will understand some Danish, and the good people of Sweden will understand it. But that's about it. That's a problem if you want to operate a journal online, because we're not big enough to be interesting, economically viable, interesting for professional publishers. So some of the journals were having problems to get recognized and published. We also had an idea that we want to help existing journals, Danish journals, to become digital at the beginning of this work and make sure that they were open access and could be part of the open science society. And of course, we wanted to help new journals to be born. Science is changing, new topics are coming up, and we need to ensure that Danish journals have a possibility to be published in Danish. We also use the system, especially to help the people in Aalborg, to ensure that journals from a given university can be presented online as a collection. And then we realized with all the work that servers like this requires IT and knowledge about IT that the editorial teams of the journals do not have themselves. When we start to talk about all this coding, it's all black for them. And if they had to operate a server like this, it would be very expensive for each journal to have one. So we decided to have the service. And then there is a problem about open access. Well, a problem. They don't get any money from subscriptions anymore because material must be open access. So they don't get any funding. And we realized that APCs is not something that are used by Danish journals. They look at us very strange. Sometimes it seems like we say something naughty when we say, yeah, you can take in money. But the result is that they don't have any kind of income. And that makes it hard to publish and use technology. So we need a system like this. And then we come to OGIS, and I am a big fan. There might be other systems. I heard about them today. But it covers the entire workflow for submission to publication in one go. That helps the editorial boards a lot. Then it distributes metadata on a professional level. We're sure that other systems can read what we're doing. That is a big help. And we can integrate with DOI, DOAJ, and ORCID and things like that in a professional manner. It sort of works all the way through. And finally, OGS is open source. It has many users and a great community. We are lucky to have good contact with our friends from Sweden and people from Norway. And every time we meet with them, we learn something new, even though we have a fairly big server, because there's always another angle to do things that we did not consider. You tend to get snow blind thinking that the things you do are the perfect way to do it. And the present server could not be there without the good help from the Finnish server, journal.fi, because we quite simply were allowed to take their setup, their homepage design, and use on our server. So we're quite happy that we're good friends with them. Now, the next question would be, why should libraries do this? A couple of years ago, I did count the Nordic OGS servers as a sample to see who's working with this. I was quite new in the business and had no contacts, so I thought, why not count? And mostly university libraries and scientific societies are publishing, and actually, normally, it's university libraries, except in Finland, where it's a journal.fi, which is from a scientific society. And as far as I remember, Norway was a bit different, with more servers, operated for one journal at the time. Most of the journals were from social science and humanities. That might have changed, but there was a clear tendency. And then when it comes to services, there were some platform providers like us, and then you had some professional publishers, like the one in Stockholm that has been established. And then you have a lot of services in between, where it seems like the people on the servers are more engaged in helping to find reviewers and things like that. And one day it could be quite interesting to try to describe why the journals and the platform providers choose different ways. But it's quite obvious when you talk to people that if you're a publisher, you have more rights to change things, like to choose what kind of license that you can use, if you can use Creative Commons or not. We are not able to do that because we are a platform provider. So the choices you make give problems with the service you offer. Now, why use libraries? Well, we are used to give access to books, journals, and stuff like that, and we used to do it online. We are the people that they come to anyway. We are close contacts with the researchers regarding publications to find where to publish the articles. We better know about copyright, open access, and subscriptions, because if we don't do that, we can't do our work. And then librarians know about metadata as experts. And then the libraries are often in close contact with IT departments, because all our online services would not work anywhere without the IT people. So it seems like the libraries, the university libraries, are the natural partners for works like this. You can find other departments at university, but they'll still end up talking with us about a lot of these things. And just to conclude, our server has given access to Danish publications, yearbooks and journals. I think we have something back to the 18th century, early 18th century. A lot of it would have been hard to find. Now we can really easily find it. We have assured that it could be accessed as open access. Our experience is that they start out with embargoes, but end up being immediate open access journals. They just have to get used to it. And then we all realized that it's a service needed by the journals. They can't handle this themselves. How should they? They're scientists. They are supposed to focus on whatever topic they're working with, not about whether to have green open access or whatever. We will help them with that. And then OGS is perfect for the task. There might be other systems, I realize that, but it has worked for us. All over the time, and most of the journals actually only use the quick submit solution and do not use the entire workflow. But the journals that use it are quite happy for doing that, because they can document their work. So if an editor suddenly dies, they don't lose all the information. It's quite valuable for them. And, well, as libraries, we're often seen as a perfect partner in this kind of work. And if you're not doing that already, I would really suggest that you should start to do it. And my final slide. I am not working alone with this. We have my colleague in Copenhagen, Kanvi Iversen, a lady sitting in Copenhagen as well, Maya Ronne. She's working with IT. Then there's Nils Frederiksen, who has been working with this thing before I started at the library. He's my personal hero. He just translated the whole system into a Danish version of 3.2, which we are looking ahead to test now. And then we have our IT wizard guy, Tom G. Christensen, who sort of, if something goes wrong, is able to, you know, make things work. I had prepared for questions, but we'll take that later, I think. And some links. The first one is for tidsskrift.dk, the journal.dk. Then we have OMP focusing on Aarhus University, where you can see our catalog. And then we made a little journal called OGS in Danish, because we realized that we had to send out all the same information, how to use the system, many times. So we created the journal. And actually, it gave us some experience, because we had to decide some things that editors have to do. So we actually learned about how to operate a journal doing this. That's about it. Thank you very much.
So we are doing well to time, and my thanks to the speakers. Our final speaker is Max Haring, University of Amsterdam. We'll speak on University Journals, a collaborative open access publishing platform owned by universities and linked to repositories.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be able to present our initiative, University Journals, to this audience. It relates a lot to the things that have been discussed before, library publishing, platforms, and not necessarily kind of university presses. Today I'd like to share the aims of the project and where we wanted to go, kind of the needs we identified, and looking at how a platform like University Journals, a shared publishing platform for journal-like publications owned by universities, how that could work. The project itself is still in an investigation phase. So we're nearly ending this investigation. So I wrote a 70-page report that will go back to the funders, but also to the partner universities. And at some point, they will have to decide if this will actually happen. So it's not a done deal yet. But I have good hopes that we get, in some shape or form, we get some collaborative platform like University Journals set up in the very near future. And I will end this talk, by the way, with the with a bit of a summary of lessons learned in this investigations phase. So hopefully that might help you in your new projects in the future as well. But I'd like to start with a quote from the Scholarly Kitchen. I assume you all know the blog. It's from some time ago. And the question asked is, why hasn't academia taken back control of publishing? Of course, we all are aware of the problems with the large commercial publishers, the challenges around open access. And so it makes a lot of sense that universities, institutes, perhaps funders also, take back control of publishing. The article itself, by the way, goes into lengths describing the challenges around university presses. And while that's all valid, I don't think that's the right approach here. Because there are already so many examples of where academia actually has taken back control of publishing. But it's very often not in the form of a press. It's in the form of services, of platforms. And we as libraries are much better equipped to provide services than to set up a press. At least that's what that's my opinion. So, of course, you all know how the French repository, which is linked overlay journal system EpiSciences. There's an Amsterdam initiative called SciPost, which is a set of physics journals that are linked to Archive as Archive as a submission system. Of course, there's a whole set of open source software, open source platforms, and tools available. So there is actually a lot happening in academia around scholarly publishing. So, University Journals was set up, was conceived by a professor at the University of Amsterdam who saw really a need for a more flexible way of publishing with less constraints and less dependent on large commercial publishers. So as I said, we all know the challenges with high costs, very slow move towards a 100% open access world. And of course, at the time that he was starting this, there was still Plan S as the big changer that nobody knew about what it would actually be. This is more than a year ago. So by now, Plan S has been pretty much dealt with, and the rules are clear. But at the time, it was very uncertain what the effects would be. So there was another pressure to have our own journal, our own platform that we could control and we could make compliance to Plan S, to Horizon 2020, to whatever rules funders might impose on the researchers, without having to rely on others, commercial entities, to do it for us. And of course, if you start thinking about publishing platforms, there is very easy to set up a wish list, right? Publish more quickly, be flexible around article types, types of content you can publish, to be really transparent, support open peer review, support version control, all those stuff. Of course, also one of the ambitions from the DORA declaration is to move away from impact factors. Well, there's another thing where a platform like this could help. So there is a huge set of things you could do if you have your own platform, basically. So we started drawing a plan for University Journals. And again, I would like to emphasize, it is not a university press. There will not be an editorial board. There will not be impact factors, all that stuff. We really want to provide a service to researchers where they can publish their work relatively conveniently, relatively easy, with low costs, but still with kind of a quality control, quality aspects, and a prestigious name to it. So we have 13 university partners who signed up for the initial investigation of this project. A lot of them are based in the Netherlands, but we have also have a few universities from Spain, from Zurich, and from Sweden involved. So the initial idea focused very much on a link with institutional repositories. There's a lot of content in repositories that could have been journal publications. Why can't we have a system that can actually help researchers elevate those repository publications to kind of a published status? Actually, that part turned out to be quite challenging, and we've tuned that down a bit in the subsequent versions. But it's still in the back of our minds, and it's still really trying to use repositories as well as journal platforms and linking them together, providing a part of an open infrastructure for academic publishing. And of course, it should be diamond open access, and by that we mean we don't want to send invoices to researchers. So the cost should be paid by the institutes, by the participating institutes, perhaps by the funders, but definitely not by the researchers. And of course, as I said, it needs to comply with all the rules that are there right now, Horizon 2020, but also rules in the future, whatever Plan S comes up with next, and of course also the ambitions from the DORA Declaration. And while we're at it, right, the ambitions are high here. We also like to have help researchers more than just provide a platform where they can put their PDFs. Quality control is really important, but we know that peer review, as done traditionally by journals, is a very slow process. It's sometimes more a bit of a lottery, and it's very inefficient. If we are designing a new platform, we better take peer review into account as well. If we've discussed with a lot of our partners, with a lot of researchers, and we came up with basically a two-tier strategy. How this actually will work out is still something that needs to be discussed. What we want to do is to focus on a very quick baseline checks, quality checks, for submissions. Done by the universities themselves, because in the end they attach their name to the publication, so they need to be responsible for the content. This is not a proper peer review, right? It is not scientifically checked. This is metadata checks, quality checks on the content. Does the university know the person, know the researcher? Do they know the research? Was it funded? If a paper passes all that, it can get published on the platform. So this means that any researcher who submits a decent work can be reasonably sure that it gets published, which is very different from a lot of journals with high rejection rates. You never know. But we also identified very strongly the need for traditional peer review for certain papers. For certain researchers in certain disciplines, it's more than in others. There definitely will be an option to have traditional peer review as done by journals. And taking into account, it will just take more time. But this is an option that can be chosen by the authors, perhaps. Maybe the university wants to have it mandatory for certain types of research papers. If you actually describe research results, it probably needs peer review. If it's just a progress report, it probably does not need review. A data report itself, does data report need traditional peer review, or can it just have technical review? So we want to be very flexible there and only resort to the traditional slow peer review type when it's absolutely necessary. So this is a bit of how the platform could work, right? There's a researcher who will submit their work into the platform, but we also still want to have that link with university repository. So if a paper is already in a repository but not published yet, with a click of a button, it should be able to transfer to the platform and be submitted as a publication. So at the platform, we will do the quality assurance step and the optional peer review step for certain types of papers. And if it passes all those checks, the articles can get published. Ideally, we also have some kind of post-publication review, reader commons in there as well, although this creates a lot of technical challenges with version control, and DOIs do not handle version controls very well. So once the paper is published, we also want to put a lot of effort into dissemination, because in the end, that's what gets the readers to the papers, and that what adds value for the researchers. So we will push content absolutely to Crossref, OpenAIR, to Google, make sure it's in Google Scholar, and basically set up any partnership we can find with large indexes, abstracting services, so they are aware of the content, and the researchers who publish on the platform know that actually the reach of their research is just as good as it would be with prestigious journals. So the content itself, the content platform itself, should have an article first approach. We don't want to see actually journals. We want to see articles. So if people use Google or whatever search engine to look for research, where they end up is the article page itself. They shouldn't end up in this volume and issue lists. We don't want to see those. Those are all they will be there, but in the background. We really want to have an article first, research first presentation. And of course, because it's all online, we can filter and allow searches in all kind of different ways, on institute level, in university level, topics, keywords, basically anything. If a reader wants to see only peer-reviewed work and not see the QA, but not peer-reviewed work, that should be a setting as well. So we are really transparent about what happens to a particular paper. And because it's all online, we can be very flexible with kind of collections, so have themed issues, but then virtual, even across different institutes, across different topics, whatever is topical at the moment, or what if there's a conference, we can have the conference papers as a collection. So you can have very quickly set up a new journal just for one conference, close the journal again after a month because all the conference papers are in. So the platform should allow that. Should be allow very flexible use of kind of the journal medium. So this is how an article page could look. So very prominently, we will display the institute or the university or the research school. We tend to be flexible there, but whatever it should be a prestigious brand. The idea is that the journal brand, which is now important and gives a bit of quality, that is replaced by the branding of the institute or the university itself. So readers know kind of the quality they expect from looking at the branding here. So we will be very transparent about what happens to that particular paper as well. So if it everything is quality reviewed, so it will get a kind of a sticker or a badge saying this was quality reviewed. If it was peer reviewed, traditional peer review, it will get another badge or sticker saying it was peer reviewed. If there is data available, you can imagine there will be another badge saying, hey, download the data here. So we really try to be as transparent as possible towards the readers about what happened to that particular paper. So, as I said, we aim to set up this platform with a lot of different partners and a lot of different institutes. So they will all be able to get their little home, basically, on the platform itself. So readers who want to see only the works from the University of Barcelona, just click on that link and they will see the entire list of papers coming from that particular university. But the same you can do for disciplines like social sciences. You click on the social sciences link, you will see everything published in social sciences across all the partners. Universities themselves get a lot of flexibility again to highlight certain papers, to group things into collections, into virtual journals. So there's a lot of ways in which universities can present their research on the platform. So we've looked at the requirements for platforms like this. And talking with all the partners and have meetings and everything else, we basically came up with three requirements. First, and the most challenging probably, is it needs to be competitively priced against commercial journals and ideally be less expensive. It also needs to be customizable. We want to have a lot of flexibility. But again, dealing with libraries who do not necessarily have experience actually handling editorial workflows, it also needs to be low maintenance. So we looked at, in more detail, four different available platforms. So we looked at developing our own platform based on open journal systems in this case. But we also looked at kind of off-the-shelf solutions. We looked at a commercial repository platform, a commercially available, also traditional university press platform, and kind of one of the modern journal platforms. And after the talk, I'm happy to share the brands if you're interested in where we actually looked at. But interestingly, actually, the top one, the developing our own platform based on open journal systems, turned out to be the most expensive option if you look at development costs. It with a very long development time, quite significant development costs. The bottom option, where you just take an off-the-shelf commercial provider with an open access platform, that one is by far the cheapest to start with. Of course, in the long run, and if you start to publish any volume, open source is by far the cheapest to run and to publish a lot of papers. Then the commercial open access platform becomes actually quite expensive. The two in between are kind of comparable in costs, but to me they tend to look kind of old-fashioned and very much like an old-fashioned type of university press, and that's not the image we want to convey. So this is where we are. We made this comparison. We compared budgets and wish lists for these available platforms. And the big question now, going back to the partners, is if any of these options that we've looked at in detail is suitable for the partners to actually approve and start developing and setting up the University Journals platform. So that's still an open question. I don't have an answer that here. There. But looking at these platforms, looking at a lot of other platforms, it turns out, again, it's one of those triangles where you have three options and you can pick two. You can have low costs and low effort, but that means you have to take something that's completely off the shelf. If you want to have a lot of control about the workflow and low effort, you need to pay a lot for it. So, right, it's one of those things. I suppose the perfect platform doesn't exist. As promised, I'm finishing off with some lessons learned. It turned out that we came up with the name University Journals because looking from the perspective of a reader, we want the reader to understand that whatever is published on this platform is a final publication. It's not a repository publication. It's not a preprint server. It should be considered a final reviewed publication. But it turned out that the name Journals, when talking with librarians, actually gave a lot of confusion about the actual means and scope of the project. Also, when we started here, Plan S was this big unknown thing hanging over everybody's heads. And a lot of doom and other scenarios were discussed. By now, Plan S kind of settled down. The dust got settled. It got a bit less strict than it was initially presented. So it seems that the urgency for Plan S solutions is slightly less, which also means that for some partners, there's less urgency to actually go with us and start University Journals, which is a pity. There's also a lot of different forms of publishing that needs inclusion. So, of course, the questions came up, what about books? What about media? For the project right now, we decided to focus on kind of journal-like publications, basically anything we can fit into a PDF. But, of course, that's not where you want to end. You want to have a flexible platform there. And finally, there is definitely overlap between what repositories do, preprint servers do, scholarly networks do, university presses do, and how does something like University Journals try to fit in there, not being any very clearly any of those, which is interesting, and I think it's a challenge, and I think it's an opportunity to change a bit, but it makes kind of selling the idea a bit more difficult. But finally, I think that's the whole message of this morning, basically. We definitely need more platforms controlled by academia. And that's the end. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. We do have some time for discussion, so I'm going to ask the presenters to come back to the platform together. We can share microphones and see what we have to say. While they're doing that, we had neglected to mention earlier that there is a Twitter feed associated with this meeting. It's hashtag LibPub2020. Jane, nod to me when I say that. LibPub2020, hashtag LibPub2020. Capitalization doesn't matter. So anyway, welcome back. Thank you all for your presentations. Let me start by asking, and we can share some microphones here, if any of you have questions or comments for each other, because you're, I understand, no technical experts in sight here anywhere, but you are the experts on this who've been talking about it. Would you have anything to say or comment?
Yes.
So I have a question actually for Cheryl, because I've been interested in Vega for a long time, since you first teased it like 2 years ago or something. So it's very exciting. Is there a journal or some type of publication already that we could like look at to see like what the publish end of it like looks like yet? Or is that still in the works?
Yeah. That's a great question. And I went back to my seat and going, I should have shown that. It's too much to show. Yes, and I can show you sort of, I've got a demo version that I can show you that has this journal called Borrowers and Lenders. It's a multimedia Shakespeare journal out of University of Georgia. We've been using them as sort of our major test case. I don't have their front end ready, but I do have a different front end. The front end has been one of the last things that we're working on because we're trying to get the other stuff ready. But there's a lot of different parts that I can definitely show you.
I have a question for probably both Cheryl and Ellie. So do you assign DOIs to your papers?
DOIs,
digital object identifiers, registered with Crossref. And how do you put in your metadata into Crossref in that case?
We plan on doing that. We haven't gotten that far yet.
Yes. So for bibliographies, actually we use DataCite instead of Crossref because that's what our institution paid for. But yes, so we register a DOI for the entire bibliography publication. We register a DOI for our entire topical web portal publications. For our monographs, we register DOIs for the like book itself and then also all of the individual chapters. Yeah, so I think that. And did you want like specifics on how we enter that information? Mostly it's by hand, and we just fill out as much as we can, unfortunately.
And we're trying to determine whether we add DOIs for the individual media assets. That's always been a question, but that, of course, gets very quickly into rising costs.
I do have one question, and then we'll throw it open. What's the hardest part of what you've done? What's most difficult? What's most frustrating? When do you want to just give up and make somebody else do it?
I'm so glad actually to have somebody from PKP here, because for 15 years I was like, I will not build a content management system that I'm then going to have to John Walensky, right? Like, John is amazing and he's done so much beautiful work with open journal systems, but I didn't want to be that person. And then here I am finding myself in that position. And so the hardest part that they've done incredibly well, and of course they've been doing this for 20 plus years, is building the community.
I would say one of the hardest things was learning Drupal and learning to speak like a developer in some ways. So again, caveat, I'm not, but learning to be able to have those questions, like have those discussions and, you know enough about the system and the way that people talk about it to be able to have intelligent questions and figure out this is what I actually mean when I say that I'm using this. I'm also very fortunate that the people that I work with at the libraries are super kind and very willing to explain, you know, how things work and so that I fully understand kind of all of the jargon and all of the functionality and whatnot, but that's probably one of the largest barriers.
Okay, for the floor. Questions here. We do have a microphone. We'll come around to you, and the folks on streaming want to hear you, so wait for that. Go ahead,
Mike. Thanks. I have a question for Marisa McDonald. Have you thought much about the cloud? The cloud as an infrastructure of the internet? And do you have in Canada something which could be called a public cloud? Okay, thank you.
Yes. In terms of, do you have anything more? We have thought about it. I'm not actually here to represent necessarily. I'm here to talk about contributing and the stories from our community. So I can't speak too much on the software itself necessarily. But yes, we do. In terms of the software utilizing the cloud, is that your question? I probably wouldn't be the best person to comment on that today, but for now it's a download. It is a desktop version. So I'm too new to say, but I would say no, it's not in the works at the moment.
I guess I could put this question also to the other speakers that when we speak about the platform for publishing, so, and we come to questions of the infrastructure of the internet and open infrastructure, as you said, then the question about the cloud gets interesting, and what is the, which cloud is going to be used by, for example, the Vega system.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time trying to understand what it is about the cloud that you want to ask. Are you asking about like cloud hosting services like Amazon or Google or?
Yes.
Okay, and who's using like which? Like, how do we decide? How do we decide which cloud services we're going to use?
The answer to your questions is yes, yes, absolutely. and these are, one could say, proprietary clouds owned by corporations.
Then, yeah, so like with, I don't want to monopolize. Do you want to answer first?
I'm probably the least qualified person here to answer that.
Well, so, okay, I mean, from what a lot of us in the room know about open journal systems, if I may also answer for that, is that, you know, that was meant originally to be downloaded and used on independent library servers, right? But now they offer the publishing services option, which probably is cloud. Actually, there's two different versions, right, that PKP has. There's the cloud-hosted version, and then there's the library-hosted version at Simon Fraser, I believe. And you all may have changed this in the last 2 years. Look at me answering for her. This is so rude. I'm so sorry. But because we use that as a case study for our own work, right? That's why I looked into this. Because then Vega has to decide, are we going to be hosted by Wayne State University's computing infrastructure locally, or are we going to be hosted using Amazon? And the system was built initially for our purposes using Amazon as sort of the test case, knowing that we would also probably host it locally. So we want to be able to offer all of those different versions. And if our own institution at Wayne State, if we outgrow their computing capabilities, Vega can scale up to the cloud overnight, right? So that we can use both potential services. Now, whether we choose between Amazon or Google or Jupyter or whatever might come next, We haven't gotten that far ourselves, but others may speak to that.
Well, we use a download variation when I started, and I think we'll continue to do that because it gives us more control to add it, to make it work together with all our other systems. And then there are some heavy GDPR problems with a user base with 15,000 people to just give that up to somebody else. So I think we'll continue to have the installation in our house.
Question from Lars.
Yep, thank you for very interesting presentations. I think Marisa said referred to Mind the Gap with 52 open source platforms. I don't need that many. There must be differences. And I understand that if you want to publish bibliographies and topical web pages, Drupal is a good solution. If you want to publish with a lot of multimedia, Vega might be an option. So it's important to know the differences between the platforms. And then I have very one very concrete question to Jesper. Tidskrift Deko, is that funded by the Royal Library as a part of their mission as a national library?
Well, that's a long story, but yes, it is. Yes, it is funded by the Royal Library, but over the time we had some agreements with other universities that they had to pay a sum for each journal that is published on the server. The server now is a result of a merger of two servers with different policies, and we sort of have to develop a complete, unique, unified policy for the server. So there are some journals that are paid a very symbolic sum for. But again, we say no to journals if we don't think they are Danish or scientifically appropriate.
But do you think it's a good idea for a national library to take up a service like hosting journals like you do?
Yes, I think it's a good idea.
Here, please.
Oh, that's loud. I've got a question for Max. I'm from the University at Oslo, and my experiences with our editorial team, I'm involved in hosting and running a journal publishing service. Our editorial teams are very closely wedded to the peer review process. So I was intrigued with when you were describing the quality checking process as opposed to full peer review. Have you discussed that with the academic communities and what sort of feedback? Because a lot of my researchers would be very negative to something like that.
Good question. And we absolutely discussed this. And interestingly, you get about a 50-50 split. Half thinks it will never work. Everybody needs peer review. And the other half thinks, this is amazing. We need that. So there's... It is not for everything, right? If you have your research papers describing new findings, you will need peer review. But there is so much more that could be published, and that's now published in repositories or on websites or as reports that could be part of kind of academic literature. It just does need to be peer reviewed. And University Journals aims to be a platform for those types of publications as well. So there, I'm absolutely confident that we can rely on quality assurance only and not do peer review and still provide a high quality publication.
Hi, I'm Nils Lahlem from the Scandinavian University Press. Although it's called University Press, we're a private company with a long history of close cooperation with the university sector in Norway and Scandinavia. But as a private company, we and often politicians argue that a private competition will give better use of public money than a state-run economy. And this is obviously state-run. And we have some considerations of quality as well. And of course, we use a lot of time to work on the researcher needs and the librarian's needs, for example, in our publishing platforms. So the question would be maybe first and foremost to tidskrift.dk, because that's very close to what we publish, national and Scandinavian and Nordic journals. But maybe to all of you, what are the costs so far for your platform solutions, and how do you see the costs and budgets going forward?
Well, we haven't looked into the economy, but we're using, I think, 3 full man-hours, man employees a year to operate the server. And then there's some technical issues with the hardware, and then we pay for GUIs. So in our budget, it's not that much. But I think your next question would be whether it should be public or private. Some of our journals actually have moved to private servers as well. I said some have moved to Aalborg, and some have moved to publishers that thought they could make a business out of it. And we don't own the journals, so if somebody comes and says, I want to move to your server, it's not a problem for us. It's the editorial boards that need to find the money to do that.
Could I just maybe comment on that? Because we have had several journals that we have been in discussions with that had gone to tidskrift.dk, and they have said, we would really, really like to come to you, but you cost money, and tidskrift.dk is free. And then, so that's, yeah, and then they go to you, of course. The quality is not that important when it comes to competing against free. So
I understand your problem. That's why we don't offer all the services that a true publisher would do. We're quite deliberate about that. So if they want to have that, they need to go to a true publisher. That's natural for us to say. We tell them each time when they come, you must be aware we do not do all this a publisher does.
And I feel like underlying your question is an issue of political economy instead, right? And the moral value of open access and academy-owned work, that if we're dumping our Elsevier subscriptions, like my university pays $9 million a year for a very poor urban institution that doesn't have $9 million a year for big deals and bundled subscriptions, then library publishing is one way to solve the access issue for our researchers. And then it doesn't come down to the economy of how many people we're employing to do this work or what the necessary levels of equal economy are, because we're not in a commercialized system.
Okay, we have to close with that. Please join me in thanking our presenters for a very interesting morning.
Thank you.
Well, yes, good morning and welcome to Oslo. The weather here is somewhat different than it probably is in Brisbane, but we're happy to have you here. Your slide presents you, Elena Danilova and Kathleen Smeaton, Publication Density Problem, publishing to bring attention to your work. Ladies, go ahead, please.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning to you and good evening to us here in Australia. So I would like to briefly introduce myself. My name is Elena Danilova, and I'm a manager of digital learning and publishing. And the second speaker tonight is Kathleen.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kathleen Smeaton. I'm the Associate Director of Data, Digital Learning and Publishing at UQ Library. And good morning to you, as Elena said, from a very warm summer evening in Brisbane.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for giving us this opportunity to talk about publication density as a problem and what the library is actually doing in order to bring attention to the work of our researchers. All right. Hopefully, we are going to go with no major problems. All right. So, first of all, we wanted to explain a little bit about what do we understand by publication density? And there's a few facts on the slides, which you hopefully can see. So if you're looking in 2014, there were more than 28,000 active scholarly peer-reviewed journals. In 2009, we actually were able to pass a 50 million mark in terms of the total number of science paper published from 1665. In addition to that, some research suggests that there's 2.5 million articles that is published every year. And according to some other research, this number actually doubles every 9 years. And to add to the problem, worldwide scientists, the number of worldwide active publishing scientists is increasing at the rate of approximately 4 to 5% per year. This particularly becomes a bit problematic in research-intensive university, which University of Queensland is. There's a little bit of data here on the slide. We just wanted to showcase that we are number one in Australia based on the Nature Index indicators. The researchers actually bring more than $300 million in research funding to the university. You see that there is 95% of UQ research is above world standard, and that data is based on the results of ERA, which stands for Excellence in Research for Australia. So basically it's like an assessment framework. If you look a little bit down, you can see that in 2019, last year, we've actually awarded 765 PhDs. In 2019, the researchers actually contributed around 12,000 publications in recognized journals. So it's a big number. Well, now, how do people actually come across research publications? There are different discovery pathways and library content discovery platforms that are improving. Is a fantastic way to find published research. But at the same time, all the various internet searching engines are becoming more and more sophisticated. So people are now able to search for data sets and not only published research, but published data as well. Also, open science and open access publishing is increasingly becoming more like a norm in scientific research community. And the researchers have pressures, some sort of pressures on being able to bring attention to their research. So they need to showcase impact and engagement of their research with general public and, you know, industry and so on. So, and more to the point, actually, repositories, publisher websites, collaborative platforms, they provide an opportunity for researchers to use social media share buttons and, you know, in that way disseminate research or bring attention to their research very proactively. So all of these factors combined actually rapidly increasing the volume of potentially relevant material that others come across when they conduct their own research. And potentially all of this is contributing to the information overload. And obviously, as good librarians, where we see the problem, we try to find solutions. So what do we do in our library is we're trying to connect readers to the published scholarly works. And for that, we use or we create various forms of engaging content and data visualizations so that people can have this interactive content retrieval. So how do we do that? We collaborate with authors of published works. We interrogate different systems, and we also help researchers produce video abstracts to bring attention to their published work and increase that discovery. So I think the next slide, in the next slide, I'm going to run a small sort of visualization that represents a project which Kathleen will talk about after we play this. It's about 30 seconds and hopefully technology will be with us. Right.
So what that video that we just played was showing was a visualization that we had done up, and you can see on the slide there that had all the sort of the like a network visualization map. And what we were trying to do is show people, help people find another way to find open access research that we have in our institutional repository. So a lot of talk in Australia around open access at the moment, and I know in Europe with Plan S there's a lot of discussion around that as well. And one of the things that we were encouraging researchers to do, and also just general members of our community, is to engage with open access research in a new way. And institutional repositories, such as the one we've got, is called eSpace. Even though they're hugely important, they're not always the nicest way to discover materials, because you're really just searching on keywords and things like that, which is, you know, obviously there's a place for that type of search. But one of the things that we were looking at doing is just how do you find things a bit with a bit of serendipity. So like in the old days, you'd be browsing on the shelf, you'd see a book, you'd look at a book next to it, and you just happen to find it. We thought we would try and bring that into a data visualization. so that people could discover this open access content in a new way. So really what we did there is people could search for a keyword and then they'd be able to view related keywords in that sort of network map. They could zoom in and out and kind of go on their own journey of discovery to find other articles that interested them. And then that would just go straight through to UQ eSpace, which is our institutional repository, to enable them to read the associated publications. But the idea was it was just a new way for people to engage with a lot of the content that is in the repository in a way that was a bit more engaging than just searching by keywords.
Okay, well, when it comes to video abstracts, that's probably a lot more self-explanatory, but how the video abstracts are useful is that they actually drive more engagement, again, with published research. And currently, I don't think a lot of publishers are offering this as an option, that a video abstract actually goes alongside with the published article. But Wiley is one of the publishers offering this as an option for about, you know, slightly over $1,700 in addition to other costs. And according to their statistics, the articles that go to in line with video abstracts have 447% higher altmetric attention score and 111% higher full text views. So another thing that needs to be mentioned is video abstracts is an easy way for and an easy format for the mainstream media to engage with. Easy to share in social media, and it's probably a little bit more engaging than, you know, for general public, not only academic community, because it has that sort of, you know, middle ground between academic language and sometimes academic jargon and laid back sort of, you know, language that we encourage researchers to use. We work together with researchers on their script and then organize through another unit within the university, professional filming, making sure that, you know, all the UQ sort of, you know, UQ logos and everything is up to date. Okay, and I'm going to play a video abstract right now just to showcase what we actually mean by that.
Did you know that malnutrition affects approximately 50% of residents in Australian aged care homes? Hi, I'm Danielle Cave, and I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Queensland School of Human Movement and Nutrition Sciences. In Australia, there is currently no best practice model for the delivery of food fortification strategies across the menu in aged care homes for residents who are malnourished or who are small eaters. My research focuses on developing best practice models for nutrition in Australian aged care homes, specifically through food fortification. Food fortification is the addition of ingredients to make foods and beverages more energy and nutrient dense without increasing the portion size. It is a common strategy as part of the food first approach, which involves increasing nutritional intake through food. As part of my research, I conducted a review of 17 studies to explore the relationships between food fortification strategies, mode of delivery, and sustainability in aged care homes. None of the included studies looked at strategies to embed food fortification within the food service system or identified staffing needs and concerns. Only two of the 17 studies measured any aspect of the costs associated with food fortification. The analysis of these studies showed that there are no clear sustainable strategies for implementing food fortification in aged care homes. However, I have identified potential enablers for sustainability, including choosing low-cost ingredients that are easy to use, which would minimize the costs associated with staff time. It was also beneficial to allocate a staff member to act as a nutrition champion, a person who supports and advocates for the nutritional care of residents. there are some potential barriers to the sustainable delivery of food fortification strategies. These include a lack of data about the comprehensive costs of these strategies, the availability of fortified foods for residents post-intervention, and the continuation of a nutrition champion long-term. Malnutrition is a critical issue in Australian aged care homes and is the business of all staff and service providers. What all aged care homes should be implementing is a comprehensive food fortification program for residents who are malnourished or those that could be at risk, such as the small eaters. Food fortification is a great strategy to prevent and treat malnutrition, but we need to investigate ways to support the sustainable implementation of food fortification within the food service system. As my research continues, I plan to look further at enablers for sustainability. Thanks for watching this video. For more information on my research, please read my article, Can Food Services in Aged Care Homes Deliver Sustainable Food Fortification Strategies? A review in the International Journal of Food Sciences and Nutrition.
We were able to create this video in November. So the journal, which was Taylor and Francis, allowed an abstract to go together with the publication. And since then, the article received around like over 400 views, and there is an altmetric score of 6. And since this is a relatively new initiative, I guess. Even the publishers don't quite know how to use it for the benefit of researchers. So this particular video was placed on Vimeo by the journal. And we know that currently Altmetrics is only looking at the information in YouTube. So in addition to that, we've placed this video on YouTube. And Danielle, this researcher, has already received quite a lot of attention, and her research was looked at. A number of organizations reached out and are willing to see how this research is going to progress so that they can take the benefits from that research and improve aged care homes in regards to nutrition. Well, that is basically all from us. So if you have any questions, we'll be happy to respond.
I will repeat questions from the audience as they are asked. So if there are questions, please. Questions, comments.
Well, I'm absolutely blown away, wowed by this presentation. And I wonder if you could ask what the level of effort and cost and time is in producing one.
So the question is, what is the level of cost and effort and time involved in producing either one visual abstract or a series for authors in your institution?
Well, I'll take on this question. Thank you very much for this question. We provide intensive training. So through the program, in collaboration with our graduate school, we provide introduction to video abstracts so that our researchers are familiar with what it's all about and why it can be useful to engage with this type of communication. And then we have a separate training session, which is actually a workshop with hands-on. So we explain to researchers how to prepare a script. We provide them with a template, which is really highly structured. So when they come to that workshop, they're actually ready. And we also do a little bit of, training them how to actually hold themselves, in front of the camera, and how to read from the teleprompt and so on and so forth. So we give them these valuable tips of how to go through the filming process as well as create video abstract scripts for video abstracts. So we do, as a library, we look through the scripts and give suggestions what needs to be changed. And Danielle's abstract, very frankly, took just 1 week from the time when she submitted her first script and to the time it was actually complete and fully finished.
So it might be a while before all 12,000 UQ articles in a year have these.
That's correct.
Obviously, yes, it is quite labor intensive, so it will be a while. And I think that there are, as this becomes more sophisticated and researchers realize the value, there are probably going to be some articles that are more suitable for video abstracts. So we're imagining that within schools and faculties, they might be selecting certain, you know, high profile bits of research or research that they might think will have a big impact that they would like a video abstract made for, because it would be impossible to do them all.
For me, it seems like it was a lot of efforts to make this visual abstract, but and of course it's a threshold for making the first visual abstract. But I guess it's important for us to just tell the researchers that they will have to prepare for being able to make visual abstracts in the future for everything that they do.
This is a comment from our host, Lars, that the first out of the box will have to be difficult and take some effort, but faculty will get used to the idea. You make me remember, Lars, the colleague who 35 years ago made fun of laser printers and the people who had gotten laser printers and were playing with fonts. And the same man 5 years later said to me, I don't know why any of these young people putting out their resumes don't have the sense to use a laser printer. Change happens. Any other questions for our Australian visitors?
How advanced is the technical equipment? Do you need a special studio for this? Or,
Question is, how advanced is the technical equipment? Do you need a special studio for this?
Yes, you do. So if you really want to produce high-quality videos, you do need to have studios. And we are well-equipped as a university. So we have Institute of Teaching and Learning Innovation who are looking to embed, you know, videos of all sorts, you know, into their education process. So, and we are able to have these studios available for us where we need them. The equipment and teleprompters and screens and everything is that's involved in producing the video.
And there change happens. In my institution, we have just renovated our main building, and in the new library, there are three small studios, two of them half the size of the stage, which are meant for faculty and students to use for whatever purposes. They would adapt perfectly. I'm going to go home and think about whether we can do something like this, something like this now with that central facility. Yeah. So,
and that's our hope too, I guess, you know, so we are giving the training sessions are focusing on developing the content, being able to engage with, you know, the camera and use teleprompters and work with the script and being able to perform, you know, in front of the camera, which is also can be quite challenging. So we are hoping as we increase the awareness and people are trying, so maybe they will be advanced enough to be able to produce videos themselves of, you know, really high quality.
Good. Well, thank you. I don't know at what time bedtime arrives in Australia, but lunchtime has arrived here. So I think we will thank you and very much for your presentation and the stimulation and wish you a good night and conclude now. So thank you. Please join me in thanking our guests.